Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
It's the Mighty Ann edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week's web wisdoms, we've got religion and history, repeating science, GMOs again, and listicles about bad animal facts and cool things about ants. Let's begin episode 342.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. I'm putting off the talk about Brexit and electricity until next week's show. There's just so much happening there, and I want to make sure you get the best show possible. So let's start off this week's show learning about the history of the idea of religion, past and present. Let's listen in.
For most of history, religion has been a central focus of human concerns. But now, in large parts of the developed world, it's become a sideshow or even an irrelevance because it's been declared untrue by the most powerful force of our age, science. But debating whether religion is true or not may not in the end be the most important move we can make. It's also key to understand what needs have traditionally driven people to religion, so we can go on recognizing and answering these needs, even outside a supernatural structure. 4000 BC, Arnhem Land, Australia. An Aboriginal Australian paints an image of a serpent on a rock. The so-called Yingarna serpent is a key part of Aboriginal religion. This creature and a few other associated divine serpents are worshipped for having done everything, created the sky, the lagoons, the mountains, they coloured the birds, they decreed laws relating to marriage, food distribution and death ceremonies. The serpents also generate rain and storms when anyone breaks the rules of the tribes. The belief structure of the early Australians is almost identical to that found in primitive religions pretty much everywhere around our planet. Religion has its origins in a desire to explain a very confusing world. It is a wild projection onto the natural realm of all kinds of human concerns. It becomes the focus of rituals to appease the possibly angry gods. Offerings are made in return, one hopes, for favours and kindness. Always there is the terror of death and the hope that the worst of it can be handled by an alliance with the gods. One comes away from the study of primitive religions full of compassion for the terrors and confusion that were responsible for generating these beliefs and for the frightening ignorance in which our forebearers were fated to live. But one also comes away with respect for our own psychological ingenuity, for our cleverness in telling ourselves stories to calm ourselves down, hold the community together, and deal with the unknown. 400 BC, Kushinagar, India. A kind philosophical Indian prince, Siddhartha Gautama, meets his end. His other title, Buddha, means awakened or enlightened one. He teaches his followers, of whom there will soon be millions, to expect constant suffering in life, but also to strive to detach themselves from their immediate circumstances and the anxious spasms of what Buddhists call the monkey mind, through reflection and meditation. In Buddhism, we see a characteristic attempt of religion to calm the minds of followers in relation to anxiety, poverty, illness, and death. The task of religion is to keep us hopeful, to stop our minds caving into terror, and to hold our hands through the worst, last days of our lives. 1025 AD, Song Dynasty, China. a sculptor produces this representation of a beautiful, kindly female Buddhist deity called Guan Yin. Guan Yin is the Buddhist counterpart to the Virgin Mary, and she fulfills a similar role as this lady, that of hearing us in our distress, meeting us with tenderness, and strengthening us to face the tasks of life. The centrality of these maternal figures in both Buddhism and Christianity suggests that mature adult lives share moments of terrible and lacerating self-doubt, which breed longings to recover some of the security and coziness of childhood. Being reasonable and adult doesn't always work. In our worst crises, we regress. We want to be held and understood and forgiven like we were 5 years old. All this religion knows, honours, and does not mock us for. 1133, Winchester, England. The poorest people in the parish of Winchester in southern England take up residence in the Hospital of St. Cross and the Almshouse of Noble Poverty. This is the oldest charitable institution in the United Kingdom, founded by the Bishop of Winchester, who has read the Gospels thoroughly and taken inspiration from Jesus' command to treat the poorest with special dignity. Though destined for the poorest, the almshouses are built on the scale of an Oxford or Cambridge college with the most beautiful, noble architecture of the day. The almshouses are a typical example of a theme found in all world religions, that of charity and of the duty of the rich towards the poor. Though there may be a regressive aspect to this, religions can be praised for moderating egoistic impulses and urging the powerful to think of the defenceless. It can be tempting to think of the poor as evil and responsible for their fate, but religions ask the powerful to imagine them always as unfortunate and worthy of a special place in the divine scheme. 1543, Nuremberg, Germany. Nicolaus Copernicus publishes On the Revolutions of the Celestial Spheres. This posts a heliocentric view of the universe, rather than geocentric version widely accepted at the time and based on the Book of Joshua. In 1616, the Catholic Church moves to declare this heliocentric theory nonsense and angrily bans Copernicus's work. However, Copernicus's revolution will not be quelled. Galileo Galilei will defend the system in a dialogue on the two chief world systems published in 1632. Again, the papacy is furious. It curses Copernicus once more and puts Galileo under house arrest. It's tempting to laugh at the Catholic Church, but the Church is trying to hold on to something rather lovely that had served humankind well, the idea of our cosmic significance, the idea that we matter, that someone out there cares. Copernicus and Galileo's theories are like the very painful end of the childhood of mankind. Their discoveries that we are but a tiny, forgotten, meaningless blue dot in the randomness of space is akin to a child discovering that his or her parents are in truth really unimportant in the scheme of things. A new existential terror will echo down the ages from these scientific discoveries. We are still dealing with it. July 1830, London, England. Charles Lyell publishes the first of three volumes of his geological masterpiece, Principles of Geology. The book uses new geological methods to show that the Earth is far older than was ever previously believed. The Bible had said it was 6,000 years old. Lyell says the fossil record proves it must be at least 240 million years old, based on his observation of marine fossils. Modern science now puts it at 4.5 billion years. In response to Lyell's discoveries, the British social critic and essayist John Ruskin abandons belief. He says his faith has been beaten to the thinness of gold leaf by such rock-bound evidence. If only the geologists would leave me alone, he writes, I could do very well, but those dreadful hammers, I hear the clink of them at the end of every cadence of the Bible verses. Science now makes it almost impossible for any intelligent person to believe in the Bible as literally true. 1835, Tübingen, Germany. 27-year-old David Friedrich Strauss publishes the first edition of the first volume of an epochal work, The Life of Jesus Critically Examined. Strauss advances the view that it doesn't matter whether or not Christ really was the Son of God, or worked miracles, or came back from the dead after being crucified, because what's important about him is the moral example he gives. His generosity, his immense tenderness to the weak, his commitment to forgiveness. You must forgive your brother 7 times 70, he notes. His humility, he lived as a carpenter, had a simple life, lived amongst the poor. Strauss initiates a new way of looking at religion. It isn't a true description of how the world actually is. It's something humans have invented to comfort themselves in highly valuable and important ways that deserve our selective reverence. 1885, Amsterdam, Netherlands. A new national museum, the Rijksmuseum, officially opens. The architect, Pierre Cuypers, has spent his career designing and restoring churches, and it shows. The building is quickly dubbed a new cathedral devoted to art, with its stained glass and ecclesiastical solemnity. The museum is one of many to open in the second part of the 19th century. It's the result of a widespread panic as to what can replace religion now that belief is in decline. One leading answer is that culture can replace scripture. The argument is that art can achieve for us many of the things that religion once did. It can be a guide, a source of consolation, a teacher of wisdom and compassion, a reminder of our better nature, and something that can, imperfectly, but still to a real extent, reconcile us to our mortality. 2006, Oxford, England. An English biologist, Richard Dawkins, publishes The God Delusion. Dawkins argues that religion is intellectually wrong and delusional, and therefore should be removed entirely from public culture. Though Dawkins just about stops from saying that people should be prevented by law from being religious in private, but only just. Dawkins's mocking view of religion coincides with deep disquiet about militant Islam in the West. The murderous ways of fringe Muslim groups seems to be Dawkins's real target. Religion just comes to seem like something a bunch of mad people could ever be interested in. Dawkins insists that reasonable people can find all the consolation they need in science and medicine. The doctor can replace the priest, the welfare state can replace charity, and the laboratory can replace rituals and ceremonies. For the rest, we have television and the news. The needs that religions answered were real and important, and despite science and TV and theme parks and cancer treatment centres, we still have many of these needs. We still have to die, we still need to be comforted, we still need to be reminded, in conditions of aggressive capitalism, of our duties to the community and to the poor. And we still need somewhere to take our disappointed ambitions, frustrations and sorrows. Religion may well have been a deep illusion, but it was an important illusion that we need to understand with sincere depth and compassion in order to know how to create functioning secular societies in our own time.
And let's pause for a little break.
Having trouble finding affordable fresh baked goods and coffee? Come down to Agora Cafe, located in the McMillan Building at UBC. There's also space available to study.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on 101.9 FM CITR Radio. Putting faith out of business with your weekly dose of skepticism. And we're back. Next up, we have a clip talking about the problems of the reproducibility of experiments in science, and how this both raises doubts about some claims, but reinforces our trust in the self-correcting methodology that we call science. Let's listen in.
In 2012, a researcher named Glenn Begley published a commentary in the journal Nature. He said that during his decade as the head of cancer research for Amgen, an American pharmaceutical company, he'd tried to reproduce the results of 53 so-called landmark cancer studies. But his team wasn't able to replicate 47 of those 53 studies. That means that 88% of these really important cancer studies couldn't be reproduced. Then, in August 2015, a psychologist named Brian Nosek published another paper, this time in the journal Science. Over the course of the previous 3 years, he said, he'd organized repeats of 100 psychological studies. 97 of the original experiments had reported statistically significant results. That is, results that were most likely caused by variables in the experiment and not some coincidence. When his team tried to reproduce those results, they only got 36 significant results, barely a third of what the original studies had found. It seems like every few months, there's some kind of news about problems with the scientific publishing industry. A lot of people, both scientists and science enthusiasts are concerned. So why does this keep happening? And what can be done to fix the system? Right now, the scientific publishing industry is going through what's being called a replication or reproducibility crisis. Researchers are repeating earlier studies trying to reproduce the experiments as closely as possible. One group might publish findings that look promising, and other groups might use those results to develop their own experiments. But if the original study was wrong, that's a whole lot of time and money right down the drain. In theory, these repeat studies should be finding the same results as the original experiments. If a cancer drug worked in one study and a separate group repeats the study under the same conditions, the cancer drug should still work. But that's not what happened with Begley's cancer studies, and researchers in other fields have been having the same problem. They're repeating earlier studies, and they aren't getting the same results. So why are these inaccurate results getting published in the first place? Well, sometimes people really are just making things up, but that's relatively rare. Usually it has to do with misleading research tools, the way a study is designed, or the way data are interpreted. Take an example from the world of biomedicine. Researchers who work with proteins will often use antibodies to help them with research. You might know antibodies as a part of your immune system that helps target outside invaders, but in scientific research, antibodies can be used to target specific proteins. And lately, there's been a lot of evidence that these antibodies aren't as reliable as scientists have been led to believe. Companies produce these antibodies so researchers will buy them, and they'll say in their catalog which antibodies go with which proteins. The problem is, those labels aren't always right, and if researchers don't check to make sure that their antibody works the way it should, they can misinterpret their results. One analysis published in 2011 in a journal called Nature Structural and Molecular Biology tested 246 of these antibodies, each of which was said to bind with just one protein. But it turned out that a quarter of them actually targeted more than one protein, and four of those actually targeted the wrong kind of protein. Researchers were using the stuff to detect proteins in their experiments, but the antibodies could have been binding with completely different materials, creating false positives and therefore flawed results. That's exactly what happened to researchers at Mount Sinai Hospital in Toronto. They wasted 2 years and $500,000 using an antibody to look for a specific protein that they thought might be connected to pancreatic cancer. Then they figured out that the whole time the antibody had actually been binding to a different cancer protein and didn't even target the protein they were looking for. So the antibody production industry is having some quality control problems, and it's affecting a lot of biomedical research. Some companies have already taken steps to try and ensure quality. One reviewed its entire catalog in 2014 and cut about a third of the antibodies it had been offering. Now, researchers could try testing the antibodies themselves to make sure they only bind to the protein they're supposed to, but that's like conducting a whole separate study before they even get to start on the main project. Most research groups don't have the time or money to do that. But now that scientists are aware of the issue, they can at least be more careful about where they get their antibodies. Having accurate tools for research isn't enough, though. Part of the reproducibility crisis also has to do with how experiments are designed. This can be a problem in all kinds of different fields, but it's especially an issue in psychology, where results often depend on human experience, which can be very subjective. Experiments are supposed to be designed to control for as many external factors as possible, so you can tell if your experiment is actually what's leading to the effect. But in psychology, you can't really control for all possible external factors. Too many of them just have to do with the fact that humans are human. One classic experiment, for example, showed that when people had been exposed to words related to aging, they walked more slowly. Another research group tried to replicate that study and failed, but that doesn't necessarily prove or disprove the effect. It's possible that the replication study exposed the subjects to too many aging-related words, which might have ruined the subconscious effect. Factors that weren't directly related to the study could have also affected the results, like what color the room was, or the day of the week. When such tiny differences can change the results of a study, it's not too surprising that when they reviewed those 100 psychology papers, NoSex research group was only able to replicate 36 out of the 97 successful studies. But it also makes the results of the original studies pretty weak. At the very least, being able to replicate a study can show the strength of its results. So some scientists have been calling for more replication to be done in lots of fields, but especially in psychology, because it can just be hard to determine the strength of the results of a psychological experiment. But the fact that journals are so selective about what they publish is another reason results of a study might turn out to be false. A lot of the time, researchers are pressured to make their findings look as strong as possible. When you publish more papers, you get more funding to do research, and the more grant money you bring in, the more likely it is that the academic institution sponsoring you will want to keep you. The problem is, journals are much more likely to publish positive results than negative ones. Say you're a biologist and you spend 3 months working on a potential cancer drug. If after 3 months you get positive results suggesting the drug worked, then a journal will probably want to publish those results. But if you end up with negative results, the drug didn't work, that's just not interesting or exciting. So negative results almost always go unpublished, which means that there's a lot of pressure on researchers to conduct experiments that do have positive results. positive results. For example, Begley, the biologist who led the cancer replication studies at Amgen, tried an experiment 50 times and hadn't been able to reproduce the original results. The lead researcher on the original study told Begley that his team had tried the experiments 6 times and gotten positive results once. And that's the one they published, that one positive result. There's so much pressure to publish significant findings that researchers might not always include all of their data in their analysis. To get around this problem, some experts have suggested creating a new standard, where researchers include a line in their papers saying that they've reported any excluded data and all aspects of their analysis. If including that statement became a standard practice, then if a paper didn't have that line, that would be a red flag. But even if researchers do include all of their data, they might just be doing the analysis wrong. Because data analysis involves math. Sometimes a lot of math, but researchers in a lot of fields like psychology and biology aren't necessarily trained in all that math. You don't always need to take courses in advanced statistical methods to get a degree in biology. So sometimes the data analysis that researchers do is just wrong, and the peer reviewers don't always catch it because they haven't been trained in those methods either. Then there are p-values. The term p-value is short for probability value, and it's often used as a kind of shorthand for the significance of scientific findings. To calculate a p-value, you first assume the opposite of what you want to prove. So say you're testing for a cancer drug, for instance, and you found that it kills cancer cells. To calculate the p-value for your study, you'd start by assuming that the drug doesn't kill cancer cells. Then you would calculate the odds that the cancer cells would die anyway. That would be your p-value. In other words, a p-value tells you the probability that the results of an experiment were a total coincidence. So for that cancer drug you're testing, a p-value of less than 0.01 would mean that there's a less than 1% chance that the cancer cells would die, even if the drug didn't kill cancer cells. Usually, the standard for whether results are worth publishing is a p-value of less than 0.05, which would translate to less than a 5% chance of the cancer cells dying just by coincidence. 5% is a 1 in 20 chance, which is pretty low. And there are lots of studies that get published with p-values just under 0.05. Odds are that for at least a few of them, the results will be a coincidence, and the findings will be wrong. That's why a lot of people argue that p-values aren't a good metric for whether results are significant. Instead, they suggest placing more emphasis on things like effect size, which tells you more than just whether an experiment produced some kind of change, but it tells you how big the change was. They also suggest more sharing of data, including unpublished data, something that's gradually becoming more popular and accepted. So yes, there is a replication crisis, and it's been highlighting a lot of problems with the scientific research and publication processes. But scientists are doing their best to solve it.
And from reproducibility to just bad science, bad thinking, let's listen in on the supposed risks of GMOs.
So we made a video about this once before, but some of the studies we cited turned out to be bunk, and in general, I think we played our cards too close to our chest when it comes to how we really feel about genetic engineering here at SciShow. So, why are GMOs bad? They're not. They just aren't, not intrinsically, and certainly not for your health. We've been eating them for decades with no ill effects, which makes sense because a genetically modified organism is simply an organism like any other organism that produces tens of thousands of proteins, but one or two of them were proteins that were chosen specifically by us humans. Genetic engineering is necessary for the continued success of the human experiment here on planet Earth, just like the advent of nitrogen fixing allowed for more fertile fields that saved millions from starvation. The fruits of genetic engineering, sometimes literally, will help us face the significant challenges of a world with more and more people and a climate that is less and less stable. Of course, just like nitrogen fixing allowed Germany to build bigger bombs, genetic engineering is a tool that can be used for good or for evil. So yes, it must be studied and controlled and understood, but that understanding has to start with, like, us. Right now! If you live in the United States, you almost certainly eat genetically modified organisms, or GMOs. Thus far, it's just plants, though pretty much every kind of meat on the market was likely fed with GM corn at some point. And it won't be long before the animals themselves are genetically modified. In 2012, the FDA reviewed a new kind of Atlantic salmon engineered to have higher levels of growth hormone using the genes of Pacific salmon and an eel-like fish called the ocean pout. They concluded that the engineered fish was safe and opened up the discussion for public comment, but still haven't announced a final final decision. GMOs are everywhere in the US. Pretty much literally 95% of sugar beets, 88% of corn, 94% of soybeans grown in the US contain traits like being insect resistant or herbicide resistant that were engineered into them. And some crops are genetically modified simply for human benefit. Around 500,000 children go blind every year because of a vitamin A deficiency. So a strain of rice has been developed that, unlike normal rice, contains enough vitamin A to keep children healthy. Or healthier, anyway. Now, the term genetically modified organism is actually somewhat of a misnomer. I mean, people have been genetically modifying organisms since the invention of agriculture. Every plant and animal species has natural genetic variability, and for thousands of years, we've harnessed this variability by practicing artificial selection. We cultivate and breed organisms to emphasize their most desirable traits. Cows that produce more milk and squash plants that survive drought. Brassica oleracea, also known as wild cabbage, has been bred so intensively that it is the wild ancestor of half a dozen different garden staples, including broccoli, cabbage, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, kohlrabi, and kale. Corn originally looked like this. Over years of selective breeding, we have turned it into a massive, crazy, giant mutant version of itself that we happily throw on the grill without thinking of the centuries of breeding necessary to turn a grass seed into a sweet and starchy masterpiece. But when we talk about GMOs today, we're actually talking about genetically engineered organisms, or transgenic organisms. We're talking about genes from one species being extracted and then fused into the genome of a different species. This is called transgenesis, and though not all GMO food is created this way, transgenic crops are by far the most common kind of genetically engineered organisms you come across. But here's the thing, engineered organisms aren't new either. We've been tinkering with food in laboratories for nearly 100 years. In the 1920s, scientists realized that they could cause mutations in plants, thereby creating more genetic diversity and possibly more desirable traits by exposing them to X-rays and gamma rays and various chemicals. Through the 1970s, these methods of mutation breeding were quite popular and completely unregulated and largely ignored by the public. Thousands of cultivars produced this way are currently on the market. It's a kind of brute force hack. Just mess the genes up, plant the seeds, and see what happens, and then breed the cool new traits back into various strains of crop. Then, in 1983, scientists pioneered a new tactic where they successfully took a gene from an antibiotic-resistant bacterium and spliced it into the DNA of a tobacco plant. Now, of course, antibiotic-resistant tobacco doesn't have any real purpose, but it did prove that single gene transfer was possible. The new practice of transgenics was born. Now, the GM industry wasn't really able to take hold until 1994, when the USDA approved something called the Flavor Saver tomato, a fruit invented by a California biotech company that was altered so that it took longer to ripen, giving it a longer shelf life. It was the first genetically engineered crop sold to consumers. The Flavor Saver, though, didn't last very long, partly because people didn't like the taste, and partly because others, mainly in Europe, were suspicious of its genetic alterations. The Flavor Saver and its non-ideal flavor touched off a debate that continues to rage. Today, most GMOs aren't found in your produce section like the Flavor Saver was. Instead, more than 90% of commercially grown GM foods are commodity crops, staples like feed corn and soybeans, which have been modified to resist herbicides or insects. These crops are used to make the ingredients in lots of the processed foods we eat, or are used as fodder for animals that we later enjoy consuming the flesh of. Probably the most well-known of these transgenic crops are the so-called Roundup Ready crops, foods like soybeans, corn, sugar beets, cotton, alfalfa, and canola that are engineered to resist the active ingredient in the herbicide Roundup. These crops provide us with some, you might say, digestible examples of how transgenic foods are engineered, why they're made the way they are, what they do, as well as what they don't do. Let's start with why they were made in the first place. The active ingredient in the herbicide Roundup is glyphosate, a chemical that inhibits an enzyme plants use to synthesize amino acids. By blocking this enzyme, Roundup stops plants from making what they need to grow and metabolize food, thereby killing them. And it pretty much takes no prisoners. So much so that it can be hard to use around plants that you don't want to kill, like your crops. So in the early 1990s, the company that makes Roundup, Monsanto, decided to develop crops that were resistant to glyphosate, so farmers could spray the herbicide over their whole crop, but only kill the weeds. See, there are these microorganisms that produce an enzyme that is unaffected by glyphosate. All Monsanto had to do was transfer those bacteria genes to food plants, and farmers could use Roundup to protect their crops without killing them. So they extracted small pieces of bacterial DNA that were responsible for making the enzyme and set about introducing them into plants. But how do you get the genes of a bacterium into the nucleus of a plant cell? On the tree of life, plants and bacteria are not even on the same branch. Well, it turns out that there are a couple of pretty interesting ways. The first involves gene guns. Yeah, you heard me. Gene guns. Gene guns do pretty much what they sound like, literally and kind of haphazardly blasting DNA into plant cells. Most commonly used to engineer corn and rice species, they start with tiny particles of gold that are coated with hundreds of copies of a desired donor gene called a transgene. Cells from the plant that's going to receive the new genes are put into a vacuum chamber and then fire away. The gene-covered gold particles are shot at the cells using high-pressure gas. Once inside the nucleus of a plant cell, the gold dissolves, and the scientists cross their fingers and hope that the DNA is taken up by the chromosomes in the nucleus, which it sometimes is. Once the transgenes have been incorporated into the plant's DNA, it can then be bred into offspring plants. It's not exactly elegant, but it's a heck of a lot more subtle than just bombarding the seed with radiation and hoping for the best. Another more recent and more effective way to create transgenic organisms involves using a soil-dwelling bacterium called agrobacterium. This is a plant parasite and a natural genetic engineer. It has an extra and quite special piece of DNA called a plasmid that can move outside the bacterium and implant itself into a plant cell. In nature, the agrobacterium uses this little trick to recode plant cells to grow food for it, but in the lab, engineers can use the plasmid as a kind of carrier for fancy transgenes, using it to infuse plant cells with new genetic material. So, whether you've used the agrobacterium or the gene guns, you now have a new engineered crop plant. But you can't just put that thing into the ground. You have to introduce this new genetic material into existing, traditional strains of the crop. This last step, called back crossbreeding, involves repeatedly crossing the new transgenic plant with breeding stock over and over again until you wind up with a new transgenic crop. At the end of the process, Monsanto had a patented plant that could be sprayed with glyphosate and survive. Previously, plants would have to be seeded far enough apart that machines could till away competing weeds, increasing soil loss and costs to the farmer, not to mention fuel consumption. Plus, Monsanto gets a whole new massive customer base for glyphosate. It's a long process. The whole thing can take as long as 15 years, but that's how just about all genetic engineering is done to your food, whether scientists are putting a bacterium's antibiotic resistance into a tobacco plant or an eel's growth pattern into a salmon. Of course, then there's the process of getting the crop or animal approved for use, which can also take quite a number of years. At the moment, it's extremely expensive, though there are some technologies on the horizon that might make it cheaper. The fact that it's so expensive and yet still economically worth doing indicates how extremely useful GM crops can be. It also means that the companies that produce them closely guard and restrict the patents and sale and growth and even research done on the crops. One of the reasons engineered foods are attacked so viciously is not because of the scientific consequences of their existence, but the economic and cultural consequences of placing so much power over our food supply into the hands of very few, very large companies. The GMO debate has become something of a surrogate for a much larger debate about economics that frankly is out of our league. There are some scientific concerns about genetically modified food. How does inserting a single gene, for example, rather than swapping out huge chunks of genetic material affect the genome at large? We used to think not at all, but it turns out that the genome is more complicated than that. Additionally, many farmers save non-patented seed for next year's crop, something you can't do with patented GM crop seed. But if your public domain seed was unintentionally fertilized by a patented strain, you might find that suddenly the seed you saved from last year's harvest to plant next year has genes owned by someone else, someone who is, it turns out, suing you. And if your livelihood depends on selling certified organic crops or selling into markets where GMOs are prohibited, the consequences can be even more dire. And of course, the traits we're engineering into crops might have potential ecological effects. Like if we're engineering in insect resistance, we want to make sure that we're not harming the insects that we do like bees and butterflies. But after having been consumed in hundreds of millions of meals by me and probably by you, and having been studied for decades, there has been zero indication that genetically modified food poses a danger to human health. That has not stopped an extremely vocal opposition from funding poorly designed studies and publishing misleading papers. We here at SciShow even reported on a study indicating that GMOs caused an increase in cancer in rats. This study, led by a guy who was not coincidentally publishing a book on the topic that same week, was published in a peer-reviewed journal and was initially taken at face value. But cherry-picked data, a lack of dose response, small sample groups, and a strain of rat that has an 80% chance of developing cancer in its lifespan eventually combined to completely discredit the study. Of course, as with any new technology, it can have unintended consequences. It can be controlled and monopolized and even weaponized, so there's plenty of reason to keep an eye on the companies making these advances. But when considering the number of hungry people on the planet, we have an obligation to explore every possible avenue to increase crop yields and decrease the amount of herbicide, pesticide, energy, and water needed to produce a crop. Traditional and advanced breeding methods need to be a part of that, and so does genetic engineering.
And let us pause again for another break.
Attention grad students, share your research, find out what's going on in other disciplines, approach your work from a new angle. Check out Fire Talks, the interdisciplinary discussion forum sponsored by the Research Commons at Kerner Library. Visit bit.ly/firetalk for more information.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on 101.9 FM, the genetically enhanced radio broadcast bringing you skepticism around the world. And we're back. Listicles are a big thing now. What's a listicle? It's a list of things. Don't quite know where the name comes from, but it's a cool sounding name. So let's sample some of this listicle stuff. First up, 9 things about animals that you thought was true, but ain't. Let's listen in.
Number 9. Dolly was the first cloned mammal. When we think of cloning, we automatically think of Dolly the sheep, who achieved celebrity status in 1997. However, cloning had been going on for quite a while before her birth. Indeed, the first animal successfully cloned, a tadpole, occurred way back in 1952. Nor does Dolly have the distinction of being the first cloned mammal. In 1995, a year before Dolly was born, 5 sheep were cloned at the same institute, and 2 of them, Megan and Morag, even survived to adulthood. The difference between them and Dolly was that they were created using cultured cells that derived from a 9-day-old embryo, whereas Dolly originated from the cells of an adult animal. It was their creation that signified the technological breakthrough that made Dolly possible just a few months later, but unlike the cloned animals to follow, Megan and Morag sadly didn't make any headlines when they were born. Number 8. There are hundreds of poisonous snakes in the world. The mistake people make here is that they assume poisonous and venomous mean the same thing, but they don't. Venom is a toxin that is injected into an animal by means of a sting or bite, whilst poison is ingested or inhaled. As such, a venomous snake and a poisonous snake are not one and the same. While there are around 600 types of venomous snakes, there are only 2 species of poisonous snake in the world, both of which are toxic to eat. The Japanese grass snake is one of them. It acquires its poison by eating toxic toads, storing the poison in glands in the snake's neck. This means that anything that decides to bite the snake's neck, a common place for a predator to strike, will get a mouthful of poison. The other species is a type of garter snake from Oregon, which eats poisonous orange-bellied rough-skinned newts, and once again sequesters the poison for its own use. Number 7. All frogs go ribbit. You can blame Hollywood for this one. Each species of frog has its own particular and unique call, so that means only one will go ribbit. The species in question is the Pacific tree frog, found commonly along the west coast of North America, including Hollywood. It was recorded locally and plastered all over hundreds of movies for years, supposedly to enhance the atmosphere of wild, remote locations. Too bad the majority of those locales, ranging from the jungles of Vietnam to the Florida Everglades, simply aren't home to the ribbit frog. Other species of frogs, meanwhile, make a variety of different noises, such as barks, grunts, trills, clucks, whistles, and growls. Number 6. Earwigs can crawl into your ear and burrow into your brain. Don't lose any sleep over this. Earwigs don't crawl into people's ears any more than other insects do, which, for those who are suddenly worried, is not very often at all, and they certainly never burrow into your brain. But if that's the case, how did earwigs get their name? One theory is that the pincers on the rear end of the insect, called cerci, resemble the tools used for piercing ears. Another is that the insect's original name was ear wing, a reference to the ear-like shape of its hind wings, but no one knows for sure. No matter the origin, though, many people through the centuries have believed the old wives' tale about earwigs having an unusual attraction towards human ears. One person who certainly thought it was true was famous Greek philosopher Pliny the Elder, who decided that the recommended way of removing one from your ear was to spit into the opposite one until the earwig was forced out. Number 5. You are never more than 6 feet from a rat. There are 2 main reasons to dislike a rat. One is that they are a huge ecological pest, driving defenseless and native animal species to extinction, particularly flightless birds, but that probably isn't keeping you up at night. The second reason, and the one that just might carry a lot more worry, is that rats are filthy, disease-ridden animals living just beneath our feet. Well, as it happens, they probably aren't. The National Rodent Survey estimates that we are usually at least 70 feet away from our nearest rats and possibly up to 164 feet. They are surprisingly clean animals, and while it isn't recommended that you find a wild rat and put it in your mouth, they carry no more diseases than any other wild mammal. And the brown rat never carried the bubonic plague. The culprit was its cousin, the black rat, which has now paid for its, admittedly unknowing, role in the spread of the disease. It is today extremely rare in the British Isles, with only a few scattered populations on remote islands or major cities. Perhaps unsurprisingly, the black rat has failed to make an appearance on any endangered lists. Grudges, it seems, die hard. Number 4. The buffalo was nearly hunted to extinction in North America. The buffalo couldn't have been nearly hunted to extinction in North America because it has never lived in North America. The animal in question is the American bison, which is only distantly related to the buffalo. You'd have to travel to Africa or Asia to see a real buffalo. So, where does the confusion stem from? The word buffalo is of Portuguese origin, stemming from the Latin bubalus or wild ox, and was applied to the water buffalo of Asia, which was introduced to the Mediterranean over 1,000 years ago. It was later wrongly applied to the bison when Europeans first travelled to North America. The word bison was only used much later, in 1774, and also means wild ox in Latin. And if you are still unconvinced, the animal's scientific name, bison bison, should leave you with no doubt. Number 3. Cow farts release a ton of methane gas. Ah, the cow. If there's one animal that can rival a car in releasing unpleasant pollutants into the atmosphere, it's this one. But the methane isn't primarily coming from overly flatulent individuals. In fact, 95% of it is coming from burps. That's right, we've been blaming the wrong end for years. The methane expelled from cows in this way is responsible for 1/3 of the UK's greenhouse gas emissions and 4% of the emissions worldwide. In fact, livestock farming creates a staggering 18% of these greenhouse gases, which is far more than all the cars and other forms of transport on the planet. Work is currently underway to create a methane-reducing pill called a bolus, which will dissolve inside a cow over several months. Number 2. Cockroaches would be the main survivors following a nuclear war. Cockroaches are tough animals, make no mistake about it. They can remain submerged in water for about a day and can live without their heads for a week, but they would actually be one of the first insects to die in a nuclear fallout. Humans die at an exposure of about 1,000 rads. Cockroaches, which only die at 20,000 rads, seem like mighty survivors, but this is nothing compared to some other insects, particularly certain species of parasitic wasp, which can withstand a staggering 180,000 rads. Number 1. Bees always die after they sting you. Bees good, wasps bad. It's a view that many of us share. We convince ourselves that wasps are mean and vicious insects that like nothing better than to ruin our picnics and sting us on a whim. On the other hand, we consider bees to be friendly, hard-working members of society that make honey for our culinary pleasure and only ever sting us if we really annoy them, because, hey, they'd die if they did that, right? Well, it depends on what bee decides to sting you. If we're talking about your average, everyday honeybee, then it probably will die if you provoke it into stinging you. This is because they have barbs on their stingers that become lodged in an animal's skin, so in trying to pull free, the bee tears away not only its stinger, but also its venom stack and part of its digestive tract, muscles and nerves. In essence, the bee rips itself apart. Most other bees, bumblebees included, can quite happily sting more than once, however, because they have smooth stingers that don't get caught in an animal's skin. Oh, but even the honeybee rule isn't completely watertight. The queen honeybee also has a smooth stinger, so she can use it as much as her sadistic little mind feels like.
And from false facts to cool insects. 10 things about ants that means you will never be able to look at them the same again. Let's listen in and learn.
Number 10. They can stitch up wounds. Minor wounds are considered just an annoyance, with advanced medicine just a call away. However, if we were in the middle of the African savannah with no first aid kit, and the nearest help we can get is still days away, fixing that little wound can mean life or death. Apparently, some tribes like the Maasai tribe in East Africa faced the same problem and found an easy first aid trick on the go, the army ant's strong pincers. If a Maasai warrior is out in the African bush and suffers a wound that needs stitching, all he needs to do is look for an army ant's nest and then pick out a few of the biggest ants he could find and have them bite both sides of the wound, then break off the body, leaving just the head. The seal created by the makeshift surgical staples can last for days and can be easily replaced if needed. Number 9. Before God created man, he created ants first. We all know that we, as a species, are relative newbies in the world of creation, evolving a mere 5 million years ago. Now compare that to a living fossil like the ant, who has been around since the Cretaceous period, about 110 to 130 million years ago. The age gap and the relative high social evolution of the ants may mean that only a fluke roll of the celestial dice made the difference in regards to what species came first. Number 8. They dispose of their dead. Only a few creatures on Earth treat their dead with some relative deference: humans, elephants, and, shockingly, ants. They even have undertakers to do it. When an ant dies inside the nest, they will carry the dead body outside for sanitation's sake, so that infection or disease cannot spread to the entire colony. Though any worker ant may carry the body outside, it seems there is a special ant undertaker that will usually do the cleaning up. Number 7. They can clone themselves. Parthenogenesis is a form of reproduction where there is no need for fertilization, making the resulting offspring a clone of the mother. A group of Amazonian ants was found to give birth to clones of themselves, creating a colony with no males around and somewhat echoing the legend of the fierce Amazons who do not tolerate male company. Not to be outdone, the males of the small fire ant, whose queens also practice parthenogenesis in giving birth to new queens, makes sure that their genetic legacy spreads on by cloning themselves. This special trick of the male small fire ant involves eliminating the female genome in some of the fertilized eggs, making the ant a perfect clone of the father. This unique reproductive maneuverings of both female and male small fire ant results in a nest composing of ants of the same species that has the genetic makeup of three completely different species: the queen clones, the male clones, and the sterile female workers with mixed genes. Number 6. They teach their young. As social insects, ants have a very advanced system going on in their colonies in order to ensure their survival. Worker ants are put into groups that does various specialized jobs like foraging, janitorial services, or caretaker of eggs and baby ants. What is surprising is that these worker ants are not born with the necessary skills already pre-programmed in their DNA to do some of these specialized works. For them to have these skills, they do what we humans do: learn it from someone who knows how things are done. The teacher ant's teaching style is called tandem running, where the teacher ant will teach a younger ant the ropes by running with it. This kind of teaching, even more surprisingly, involves a two-way interaction between teacher and student, the first in a non-human animal. If a student is a slow learner and fails in its exams, it will be relegated to some other job that does not require specialized skills. Number 5. They know how agriculture works. Among all creatures, we know of only 4 that are evolved enough to use agriculture as a means of survival: bark beetles, termites, humans, and ants. However, between ants and us, it seems they started farming first, having been at it since 50 million years ago. Before moving out of her birth nest, a young queen must first sneak inside the garden and take away some fungal pellets. These pellets will be the seedlings that she needs to start her own garden and feed her brood. Atene ants do their farming by cultivating fungi, just like humans do in farming crops. They even use pesticides to combat parasites that affect their crops. There are 5 known systems of agriculture that ants practice, but all ants that practice agriculture are shown to share some general habits in fungal gardening. Number 4. They use herbicides and disinfectant. Speaking of pesticides, ants use them, as well as herbicides, in their fungal gardens. Theirs is far more eco-friendly than ours, however. The fungal gardens that the ants grow are also home to a virulent kind of fungus that kills the fungal crops. To prevent this fungal weed from spreading, the ants have a bacteria at their disposal that they carry around on their cuticles. The bacteria produces an antibiotic that specifically suppresses the growth of the fungal weed. In their nests, they use several substances that inhibit the spread of parasites or weeds. The wood ants, for example, add solidified conifer resins to their nests while building them, which hinders the growth of bacteria and fungi. The lemon ant, which prefers to nest in trees, produces a natural herbicide that kills all other plant life surrounding their nesting tree, including grown trees. They do this by injecting leaves with herbicides, and the plants will start to die within hours. Number 3. They raise livestock. Ants do not only raise crops, but also livestock, which they use for milking. The livestock consists of insects like aphids, mealybugs, and Myrmecophagous caterpillars that secrete a sweet liquid called honeydew. The ants keep the predators away from their livestock and even herd them from one feeding location to another, just like what we do with cows. When it is time to collect some honeydew from the livestock, the ants milk them by tapping them with their antenna. The ants even bring their precious livestock with them when they migrate to a new area. Kind of reminds us of frontiermen bringing their cattle along while in search of greener pastures. Number 2. They wage wars. Imagine the scene in the final battle of Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King. Total carnage wherever you look, with the battle lines blurred out as the warring parties are jumbled up in the heat of battle, with groups of soldiers clustering together to form a cohesive front and take out an enemy at a time. Now imagine, instead of the handsome, unsullied face of Legolas and his crew, you get ants with menacing mandibles and scary big eyes of doom. The tactics ants use in warfare are eerily similar to human war strategies, and they even vary their tactics depending on what is at stake. They can even use propaganda pheromones to confuse enemy ants and make them fight among themselves. There are even species of ants like the Amazon ants that oddly resembled the fabled Spartans in their way of life. Namely, they only survive through waging wars to replenish their slaves and to get more resources from other colonies. They even act like medieval knights when in their nests, doing nothing more than demanding food from their slaves and burnishing their chitinous armor. Number 1. They practice slavery. As a whole, ants are known for being hard workers, but just like humans, there are some rotten apples in their baskets. There are several species of ants that are dependent on slave labor for survival and who will actively wage war against other colonies to steal the pupae and enslave them upon hatching. The most rotten apple in the bunch is a species of ants called Polyergus breviceps, which, interestingly, is endemic in the United States. This species of ants have lost their ability to take care of their young and even themselves. They do not forage for food, feed the young or the queen, or even clean up their own nest. This kind of behavior would mean certain extinction for most species, but these ants have a superior weapon up their sleeve, weapons of mass subjugation. The warrior ants will attack a nest and release a formic acid against the defenders. This will trigger panic among the ranks and crumble their defenses, making it a breeze to steal the pupae. If that is not enough, they have a more formidable weapon, their queen. The queen of Polyergus breviceps is capable of releasing pheromones that will reduce the aggression of the defending ants, making them easy for conquest. In some instances, when the ants badly need more slaves, the queen will go out with the warriors to war. After releasing her pheromones to crush the aggression of the defenders, she will immediately look for the queen of the overtaken nest and kill her. Everything is not lost for the slaves, though. Every so often, they stage rebellions against their masters by ripping apart the larvae of those that enslaved them. This means the slaver ants have less chance of going out and conquering more, as their numbers are quickly dwindling, thus saving other ants from slavery, one baby ant at a time.
And lastly, 25 towns that changed their name. Let's listen in.
Did you know that in 2005, the town of Clark, Texas, officially renamed itself to Dish, Texas? The satellite TV company Dish Network offered residents free service and equipment in exchange for the rename. The agreement ends this year, and the town hasn't yet decided whether to renew the deal or become Clark again. And that's the first of many towns that changed their names. You'll remember from our episode on the 50 states that Topeka, Kansas, once briefly changed its name to Google in order to encourage Google to install fiber internet there. That's how desperate we are for real broadband! In 1950, the television show Truth or Consequences was about to celebrate its 10-year anniversary, so it offered to broadcast its anniversary episode from any American town that would change its name to Truth or Consequences. Hot Springs, New Mexico won and has kept the name ever since. There's a Beverly Hills in New South Wales, Australia. The town was originally called Dumbleton, but the citizens hated it, so they renamed it Beverly Hills in 1931 after the town in California because they associated it with Hollywood glamour. Little did they know, if they just stuck with Dumbleton, one day they would be associated with the greatest headmaster that Hogwarts has ever known. Although locals still call it Gayhead, Massachusetts, the town was officially renamed Aquinnah thanks to a town vote in 1997. Now, people believe it's because the original name sounded risque, but the man who started the petition to change change it didn't cite that as a reason. His rationale was, this is an Indian place and it should have an Indian name. In 2015, the city of Oregon, Ohio had a problem. The Ohio State Buckeyes were set to play the University of Oregon Ducks in the College National Football Championship. So the city officially renamed itself Oregon, Ohio, Buckeyes on the Bay, City of Duck Hunters for about a week. And sure enough, Ohio State won the national championship that year. The village of Cross Keys, Pennsylvania renamed itself Intercourse in 1814. According to the village's website, there are a few theories about why the name was chosen. One is because the word intercourse means social interaction and support. You know, like Batman and Robin's relationship. Speaking of Pennsylvania, the town 84 Pennsylvania used to be called Smithville, but it turned out that there was another Smithville, so it was renamed in 1884. The new name also might have had something to do with that being the year that the great Grover Cleveland was elected to the presidency. Smithville. Now 84, was just so excited. Who could blame the residents of the former Smithville for being so incredibly excited about the election of the great Grover Cleveland, who has the best first name of all the presidents? You heard me, Millard Fillmore. Anyway, in 1995, Bombay, India officially became Mumbai. This happened because the Hindu Nationalist Party Shiv Sena got control of the state assembly at around that time. They believed that Bombay was a reminder of British colonial rule, so they switched it to Mumbai, a reference to the Kali goddess Mumba Devi. Holyoke, Massachusetts used to be called Ireland because of all the Irish immigrants who lived there, but eventually it was named for the son-in-law of a settler, William Pynchon, who was like, I like my son-in-law, let's call the city after him. Thanks to the great They Might Be Giants song, you probably know that the capital of Turkey, Istanbul, used to be called Constantinople, but in fact the city has actually had over 8 names throughout its history. Istanbul, which means the city, became the official name in 1930 because the postal service required one consistent name. Berlin, in Ontario, Canada, changed its name to Kitchener during World War I due to animosity toward the Germans. The proposed name change in 1916 wasn't particularly popular, but it was put to a referendum in which the option to keep the name Berlin was not on the ballot. Only about 900 people in the town of 15,000 showed up to vote, and only around 350 voted for Kitchener. But it still won. Mira Loma, California used to be Wineville, but then it changed its name in the 1930s to disassociate itself from the Wineville chicken coop murders in which multiple young boys were murdered in the 1920s. Back when it was just a settlement, Enigma, Georgia was known as Gun and Weston, which would be a very popular town name today. But they eventually named it Enigma because, according to the town's founder, it was a puzzle what to name it. Man, if they wanted a puzzle, they should have just named it Tetris. Arab, Alabama was supposed to be called Arad after the son of the town's founder, but the U.S. Postal Service messed up and the name Arab stuck. The Russian city of Volgograd used to be called Zaritsyn and then Stalingrad after Joseph Stalin. Khrushchev's administration changed the name in the 1960s, but some people still referred to it as Stalingrad. Now, showing that Russia is just a smidge more Stalin-y than it was under Khrushchev, the title Hero City Stalingrad is allowed to be used on 9 celebratory dates, like February 2nd in honor of the end of the Battle of Stalingrad. In the late 19th century, Pile of Bones, Canada was renamed Regina, which is Latin for queen. It was originally named for the piles of buffalo bones left by the First Peoples, who kept the piles there because they believed the buffalo might return to the same spot. I don't know if you know this, but Mental Floss executive producer and director Mark Olson is himself from Pile of Bones, Canada. He says that he's from Edmonton, but from now on I'm calling every city in Canada Pile of Bones. When the city of Wellington, New Zealand was asked to host the world premiere of The Hobbit: An Unexpected Journey in 2012, it was renamed The Middle of Middle Earth that week. They even changed their city's main newspaper title to reflect it. The Japanese town containing Toyota's main plant was renamed from Koromo to Toyota in 1959 because the plant was so big that it allowed the village to become a city. Though the city of Guangzhou, China was never officially named Canton, that's what Westerners knew it as between the 1500s and 1900s. It's believed that the name came to be when the Portuguese put a trading post there and mispronounced the name Guangzhou very, very badly. But to locals, it's been called that since about 190 CE. In 2000, the town of Halfway, Oregon accepted a deal from the website Half.com to rename their town to Half.com for a year. Which reminds me, whatever happened to Half.com? The town of Lake City, Florida was once a Seminole village with a name that translated to Alligator Village. But when the city was incorporated in 1859, there was already a neighboring town named Alligator because, you know, Florida. So they had to switch to Lake City, which is unfortunate because Alligator Village is a much better description. Speaking of which, Lake City, Tennessee was renamed Rocky Top in 2014 because developers wanted to build a theme park there named after the song. What they didn't know was that rights to the song were already owned, so the name change was approved, but any souvenirs for the town might be considered copyright infringement. Unalaska, Alaska is an Americanized version of Unalashka, the Russian version of what the indigenous people of the Aleutian Islands of Alaska named it. In their language, it meant near the peninsula, and then in 1788, the Spanish took it over and renamed it that. But within a century, the Russians took it back, then the US bought it, and Unalaska became the official name, but now millions of people just call it Dutch Harbor, because that's what they call it on Deadliest Catch. And finally, I returned to my salon to tell you that Mauch Chunk, Pennsylvania was renamed Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania in 1953 when the Olympic medalist died. Thorpe was actually born in Oklahoma, and although he did play sports in Pennsylvania growing up, that was about 100 miles away from Mauch Chunk. His wife, Patricia, wanted money upon his death, and Mauch Chunk was willing to pay and change their name so they could get a monument to the former decathlon runner, and now his grave lives there. Well, to be fair, I'd pay almost anything not to be named Mauch Chunk, Pennsylvania.
That's all the time we have this week. This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos.